So we're in chapter 10, which is Jesus' instructions to his disciples as he sends them out. And Jesus is sending out the disciples to do the same things he's been doing. They're to announce the good news. And they're going out with authority to heal people. And it really is fantastic news, isn't it? And the miracles show us that. Imagine being someone with leprosy and hearing reports of Jesus going around healing lepers. Imagine being someone who's blind and hearing reports of Jesus going around healing blind people. Good news. Imagine being the family of someone whose loved one has just died, or family of someone whose loved one is demon-possessed and hearing about Jesus. It's good news. And the good news is even better than that. When Jesus helps these people, he helps them from a place of hopelessness into a new life. And it's a picture of what Jesus is doing spiritually. Every human is a spiritual leper, spiritually dead, and is spiritually trapped by the devil, and is spiritually blind. That's the state we're born in, completely hopeless situation. And we should have nothing to do with the kingdom of heaven. But Jesus heals us fully, gives us life, sets us free, opens our eyes through his life, death, and resurrection. And all we have to do is ask, accept, believe. Previously, we're heading towards death. And the coming of the kingdom of heaven means nothing but our destruction because we're no part of it. But now, if we're attached to Jesus, if we die, we can go through death, follow him into a new life, into the kingdom of heaven. A new life on a restored earth as part of his family, and that life will never end. So you'll understand the quote from William Tyndale, which Sandy gave us a few weeks ago. Tyndale described the good news as good, merry, glad, and joyful tidings that make a man's heart glad, make him sing, dance, and leap for joy. So I wonder what the disciples thought as they went out bearing this good news. What did they think about the reactions they would get? Did they expect singing and dancing and celebrating in the streets? On the 14th of May 2005, my sister got married in Terrassa, which is about 12 miles north of Barcelona. And also on that day, FC Barcelona won La Liga, the Spanish Football League. And it was a particularly sweet victory for them because it had been 6 years without any trophy whatsoever, which is a long time for Barcelona. And as we left the wedding reception, the streets were absolutely full of people. This is about 2 a.m. and cars driving around beeping their horns. And I remember one child, can't have been more than 9 or 10, with her head out of the car sunroof waving a Catalonia flag. And I wonder whether the disciples thought it would be like that, with people celebrating in the streets. Well, many people did receive the good news like that. And we know some sang, we know some leapt, and probably some danced for joy, I don't know. But if you listen to Fran read the passage this morning, you probably notice that Jesus is talking about the other side of the coin, the opposite type of reaction. Jesus is warning the 12 disciples as he sends them out. And verse 22 is a good summary of the passage. You will be hated by everyone because of me. So is Jesus also warning us? Is he saying to you, you will be hated by everyone because of me? I think that's a good question to ask. Sometimes when we read the Bible, we can do it in a self-focused way and just think, what is this saying to me? What is this telling me to do? But as a rule of thumb, it's best to remember that the Bible is not primarily about you. It's about Jesus. It's not a handbook for life. We shouldn't just pick it up and assume anything we read is some sort of instruction or advice to be followed by us. That said, I actually think this passage can pretty much be applied and used like that. And there's two main reasons I think that. First, if you look at Jesus' instructions at the beginning of chapter 10, you'll notice they seem to start by addressing the immediate mission he's sending the disciples on right there and then. But they move on to something later in time, something in future for the disciples. So if you look at verse 5, Jesus says, "Do not go among the Gentiles." That instruction clearly applies in a particular way to that particular mission. And the disciples later did go to the Gentiles. But if you look at verse 18, Jesus says, "You will be brought before governors and kings as witnesses to them and to the Gentiles." Well, that doesn't really tie in with the "do not go among the Gentiles" bit. And also the disciples were only brought before governors and kings later on future missions, not on this specific mission. So at the very least, Jesus' instructions are looking forward to future missions by the disciples. And I think the warning is one of those parts that's looking to the future. And the other thing is the reason that they will be hated. So verse 22 again, you'll be hated by everyone because of me. The disciples will be hated because of Jesus. So this is because they follow Jesus, because they like Jesus, because they recognize Jesus as king and tell other people that. And that's not particular to those 12 disciples. Should be the case for all followers of Jesus. So the warning about being hated because of Jesus is not particular to those 12 disciples. I'm not saying the 12 disciples didn't have a special mission. They did have a unique and special mission, but the reason they were hated was because of Jesus. And we have the same reason to be hated today. So I think the passage we're looking at today can, most of it at least, be directly applied to all Christians throughout history, wherever they are sharing Jesus with other people. And so if you're going to share Jesus with other people, then Jesus has given you this warning. And if you look at what happened to the 12 disciples and what happened to Christians throughout history, Jesus' warning has rung true. While many, many people have accepted the good news with singing and dancing, many have hated the good news and hated Christians. Right up to date, it's a terrible time to be a Christian. A couple of years ago, a secular human rights organization estimated that 80% of all religious persecution in the world today is against Christians. Once you try to count up the number of countries in which Christians face persecution, you get to around 150, which is about 3/4 of the countries on the earth. I don't want to give you specific examples because that might distract from the scale and the breadth of what's going on. And if you don't know anything about that, I'd encourage you to maybe do a little bit of research. A good place to start would be the website of an organization called Open Doors, who try to keep track of Christian persecution. But zooming in now to our country, the UK, right now, we do live in a time where, generally speaking, it's easy to be a Christian. We can look at the past 100 years as being unusually kind to Christians. You can be ridiculed, you can be criticised, you can severely damage your career. But it doesn't seem to get much worse than that, and indifference seems to be the most common reaction to Jesus. That said, though, there are many caveats we could give. We don't like being ridiculed or criticised, and we'll change our behaviour to avoid it. And the pressure of losing a job is not to be sniffed at. I mean, that's serious pressure. So although we're not talking about physical harm and arrests and labour camps, it's not as if we could just shake it off easily. Also, our country doesn't contain just one culture. There are a variety of cultures, especially in the cities, and London's no exception. And some of those cultures are extremely hostile to Jesus, so much so that if someone becomes a Christian, they'll be cut off from their family. They'll be viewed as having betrayed their family at the deepest possible level of identity. Treated as dead and cut off. And just because we're in the UK right now doesn't mean we always will be. I'm sure many of you will end up in different countries where the situation is very different. And I know some of you spent time in those countries already. And just because it's not too bad right now doesn't mean it will stay that way. I think it's fair to say most people think it's probably going to get worse for Christians in this country. How quickly or in what way exactly, of course, is impossible to say for sure. So although the hatred is not so bad right now, that doesn't mean we don't have to pay attention to this warning. And a key thing to remember, Jesus is warning these disciples at a time before they've experienced the hatred. So that's going to happen for them after Jesus' arrest, really. So in the same way as the disciples, we're being warned before we experience it. So let's actually consider Jesus' warning in more detail now. I think there's three main points we're going to cover. Why you'll be hated, who will hate you, and why is Jesus warning us? So why will you be hated? Well, we've already answered this, really. Our passage gives a clear answer, I think. Verse 22, you'll be hated by everyone because of me. And verse 18 as well, on my account, you'll be brought before governors, etc. It's because of Jesus that you'll be hated. And just in case we're not sure whether Jesus is actually right about this, he gives us a sort of proof at the end of the passage in verse 24 and 25. He's effectively saying, do you think you're better than me? Do you think you're somehow going to avoid the hatred that I couldn't? So verse 24 and 25 again. The student is not above the teacher, nor a servant above his master. It is enough for students to be like their teachers and servants like their masters. The head of the house has been called Beelzebul. How much more the members of his household? So if you're members of Jesus' household, and what a privilege that is, do you think you'll be treated more kindly than Jesus was? When you stop and think about Jesus' life, it's obvious, isn't it? He was the most loving person there's ever been. Perfect combination of mercy, justice, grace, challenge, kindness, strength in word and in deed. He was never distracted and always did the right thing. And what was the world's reaction? Well, they attacked him, they lied about him, they arrested him, and they put him to death. They said he was Beelzebul, the devil. So you'll be hated because of Jesus. There are several surface reasons why people hate Jesus. A good way to see that is to read through the Gospels and to read through Acts and see how people reacted and the reasons. And you'll see a love of money, a love of power. You'll see people getting upset because Jesus associates with unrespectable people. And you'll see self-righteousness, and you'll see lots of other things too. All those reasons come back to Jesus, who he is and what he's like. And it's because of Jesus they'll be hated. So a question for you to ponder, perhaps. What does someone look like who is Christ-like? What reputation do you think they have? So who will hate you? Jesus also warns us who. First, the religious establishment will hate you. It's the religious establishment which will attack you, and it's them which will hand you over to the secular authorities. Listen to verse 17 from a slightly more word-for-word translation. Beware of men, for they will deliver you over to courts and flog you in their synagogues. In the beginning of verse 19, when they deliver you over. So it's the same they who will flog you in their synagogues that are delivering you over to the secular authorities. I remember who it was who hated Jesus most when he was doing his ministry. It was the religious leaders of his day. It's not hard to come up with other examples from history. Martin Luther, for example, during the Reformation, was hated by the established Western Church. In the 18th century, John and Charles Wesley, who started the Methodist movement, they were hated by the established Anglican Church. They were denounced. They weren't allowed to preach in church, so they had to preach outdoors, which John Wesley particularly was very uncomfortable doing. In the 19th century, Salvation Army was hated by the Anglican Church. In the House of Lords, one bishop would once repeated fictional stories of sexual immorality taking place at Salvation Army meetings. And today, there are many in power in the Church of England who strongly oppose those who proclaim the good news of Jesus, including vicars and bishops. And I say that not to stir up division or controversy, but simply to echo Jesus' warning. Organized religion will hate those who proclaim the good news about Jesus. You can't assume that everyone who wears a dog collar or a purple cassock is a disciple of Jesus. Don't ignore the warning Jesus is giving. The examples I mentioned this morning are from England and Europe in the time when the established religion claims to be Christianity. But of course, in other places and other times, the established religion will be a different one. But the same warning applies. So religious establishment and the state. So there's a link, as I said, between the organized religion and the state, with religion handing people over. Verse 17 and 18 again. Be on your guard. You'll be handed over to local councils and flogged in the synagogues. On my account, you'll be brought before governors and kings as witnesses to them and to the Gentiles. So organized religion will hand you over to the secular authorities. And if you remember, that's exactly what happened to Jesus the Jewish religious leaders handed him over to Pontius Pilate. The religious establishment, the state, family, close family. Jesus says in verse 21, brother will betray brother to death and a father his child. Children will rebel against parents and have them put to death. And it can be slightly troublesome and confusing the way Jesus always seems to be against families being at peace, and he always seems to be stirring up division in families. You'll see it again in verse 35 and 36, chapter 10, where he says, for I have come to turn a man against his father, a daughter against her mother, a daughter-in-law against her mother-in-law. A man's enemies will be the members of his own household. And I found myself thinking, why does it seem like Jesus is always getting at families? I think the one thing which made it click for me in this passage is simply the recognition that families are split when someone becomes a disciple of Jesus. It happens, and it happens all the time. I've mentioned it already. Looking at the world as a whole, most cultures have an essentially religious basis. And if a member of the family converts to Christianity, a likely reaction is that the family will hold their funeral, either symbolically or literally. So with that in mind, Jesus' warning, brother will betray brother to death and father his child, is not anti-family. It's just an accurate description of what has gone on and what is going on. So religious establishment, state, family, well, it's everyone, isn't it? All types of people. You'll be hated by everyone because of me. So why is Jesus giving us this warning? I think he's warning you so you don't react in the wrong way. You could react by giving up, for example. Simply give up following Jesus, or to give up sharing Jesus with other people. But Jesus has warned you beforehand it's going to be hard, and I think, therefore, much more likely to stick it out. There's no small print with Jesus. He's completely honest about what you'll face if you're sent out by him. You can be ready for it. If Jesus hadn't told you, you'd be hated. When it happens, you might be confused and you might think Jesus is not in control, or he didn't know it was going to happen, or he'd abandoned you. But instead, even though it might be very, very difficult, you'll know that Jesus is in control. He hasn't abandoned you. You could react to being hated by being defensive, to giving in to a sort of us versus them attitude, to cutting yourself off from the rest of the world. You can warp your belief in Jesus into a sort of told you so sort of belief, where you don't actually care for anyone, but all you care for is for being found to be in the right. I'll give you a silly example of this. From around 1994 to around 2002, I was a fervent volunteer evangelist for Apple and Apple products. I'd regularly argue, persuade, and prove that Apple computers were far superior to anything else, especially anything that ran Microsoft Windows. You have to understand it in the context, though. This is before the first iPad in 2010, or iPhone in 2007, or iPod in 2001. So I was recruited in Apple's darkest days, when they were close to bankruptcy, before Steve Jobs had come back. So there were few people who used Apple computers and who understood how superior they were. And those few special people, me included, received gentle ridicule from anyone we tried to persuade, especially from IT professionals. And this created an attitude of us versus them. It became not about whether Apple computers were superior, but about being in the minority who were right, whereas the vast majority of people were wrong. I did realize that one day, and realized that if Apple actually became successful, I wouldn't want to promote them anymore. And that's, of course, exactly what happened. But you have to understand, this is in the late 90s, that seemed extremely, extremely unlikely. It was around 2002 when the iPod came out that I stopped convincing people. It was either that or it was because I got a girlfriend, I don't know. It's a silly example, as I said, but I think people's faith can be warped in that way when they're hated. So there's many ways we could show how this is wrong, but a good example within reach is that first reading we had. Remember Jesus' reaction to the crowd? The crowd are harassed and helpless. And Jesus has compassion on them. That's his motivation. He cares for them deeply. So maybe an example of what that might look like in practice. Let's say our society goes against God's laws in a particular way. And let's say Christians try to persuade society not to do this, but just receive abuse in return. The response of Christians to the abuse should not be to cut themselves off, or to leave people to deal with their own choices, or to get onto their high horse and say, well, you should have listened to us. The response should be that of Jesus, compassion. So don't look for trouble either. Sometimes people enjoy controversy or enjoy a fight. They might be hated not because of Jesus, but just because they're annoying. There's no space for that in what Jesus is saying. In verse 23, Jesus says, when you're persecuted in one place, flee to another. And I also think that's what Jesus is talking about in verse 16 with the various animals. I'm sending you out like sheep among wolves. Therefore be as shrewd as snakes and as innocent as doves. Well, when you send sheep out among wolves, the sheep get torn to shreds very quickly. So Jesus is sending you out into extreme danger. Therefore, be as shrewd as snakes and innocent as doves. So snakes are shrewd. They know other animals are not their friends and don't like them, so they hide whenever possible. But doves are a picture of innocence and purity, so you have to be both. Avoid danger, but don't do so at a cost to your innocence and purity. So also, another way you could react wrongly to being hated is by changing what you're doing. So it might be that you just aren't brave enough and you soft pedal things about Jesus that you think will offend people to try and keep from being hated. I'm afraid as an individual I do that quite regularly. A slightly different reason you might be pushed to change what you're doing rather than just fear. It can simply be that you didn't expect it to be like this. So if you've not heard Jesus' warnings about being hated, and then you are hated, you naturally start thinking, well, what am I doing wrong? And this can lead you to change the message or lead the church to change what they're doing for the wrong reason. So can I put that point to you the other way around? You know when you think, oh, I wish the church would be like this, or I wish the church would start doing this or stop doing that, or I wish the church wouldn't argue so much, or would be more faithful to the Bible or more clear with its message, or I wish the church would be more relevant or more loving. Well, imagine it was for a moment. Imagine the church in the UK is everything you hope it would be, or better even, perfect. No denominations, just one visible church of Jesus. All teaching being completely faithful, urgent and genuine. The church being full of love, and the church showing incredible sacrificial love to those around. The church having a clear and consistent message on the moral questions of the day, and that message being full of the love of Jesus. Picture all church communities being so full of love that there are never any arguments or ill feeling between the members. In general, just picture every individual inside the church and the church as a whole being completely and perfectly like Jesus. Just picture that and then think, how would the world react? And I hope you've got an idea of what the answer to that question is by now. It would be a very mixed reaction. Some would leap and sing and dance for joy, and some would still hate the church. So that's challenging, isn't it, to how we decide what to do as a church. And that is that proof again, really, in verse 24 and 25. The student is not above the teacher, nor a servant above his master. It is enough for students to be like their teachers, and servants like their masters. If the head of the house has been called Beelzebul, how much more the members of his household? The reason this was such a challenge to me, I think, is because I had an unchallenged assumption that if the church just sorted itself out, sorted its PR out and just sorted itself out generally, that the world would react positively, that the world would speak well of us, that the church would be welcomed by everybody. So therefore, we shouldn't decide whether the church is doing the right thing on the basis of whether it's popular or whether we get a strong negative reaction or strong positive reaction. If we get a strong negative reaction, it doesn't necessarily mean we're doing anything wrong. It might mean we're doing the right thing, but that's not the basis on which to make the decision. So don't give up, don't be defensive, don't look for trouble, don't change what you're doing. And I'll just finish with the bit of the passage that's probably the hardest to understand. That's the second half of verse 23. Truly I tell you, you will not finish going through the towns of Israel before the Son of Man comes. It's tricky because it's difficult to pin down exactly what Jesus means with the timing. But I think the image he's describing is important for us to remember. I think it's the image of the temporary nature of the mission. The mission that Jesus sent them on is not indefinite. It's time limited. It doesn't go on forever. There's a time limit to the hatred and the persecution, and there's a time limit to sharing the good news. You'll still be sharing the good news with people when Jesus returns. The mission is temporary, but the results are eternal. Only the kingdom of heaven has a future, and everything else will be destroyed. Inclusion in the kingdom is wholly determined by your response to the king. And our country needs to know that. The religious establishment needs to know that. Our families need to know that. Our friends need to know that. Our work colleagues need to know that. Everyone needs to know that. And we might be hated for sharing it, but it's the most loving thing we can do. So we're going to sing again now, facing a task unfinished. And this hymn was written by a man called Frank